It was just over a year ago that we had the poet, troubadour, youth minister, Rick Maskin here in our service. He and I have become quite good friends over the past 6-7 years. We're hoping to get a book out on the very unique ministry he's had in our UU movement, which began back in the 1960s. Rick's traveled far and wide across our UU landscape over the past 40 years while maintaining the same home for almost all of his adult life in Carmel, California, where he's been named that community's poet laureate. His signature poem and song, as many of you know, is Let It Be a Dance. It's number 311 in our hymnal. We'll be using it for our closing hymn. We're not going to sing it just yet. You may be ready. I've got a few things I'd like to say first. But we're running a little late this morning, but we'll get there. The story about how Rick came to write this song, and I think he told it while he was here, is very tragic and also very touching. Sets the stage for a few thoughts I want to offer on the theme of a line from the song, through the good times and the bad times too. The story of the song's origin goes back to the 1970s when Rick's two daughters, Jerry and April, were in high school in Carmel, taking a class in modern dance. It was being taught by a very young, energetic teacher that wanted to do things for her class. During the Christmas vacation of that year, this teacher noticed that a famous dance ensemble was doing a concert presentation in San Jose, California, which is about 80 miles from Carmel. She offered to drive any students who wanted to go in her Volkswagen bus to see the show. Rick's daughters weren't able to make it because of some other holiday commitments they had. And it was on the way home that a very horrible tragedy struck. It's just before Christmas. A drunk driver pulled out from a side road into the path of the bus. The young teacher was not able to stop in time. She, along with the two of the students in the bus, lost their lives in the crash. Among the survivors was a high school named Barbara Broussel, who was one of the best friends of one of Rick's daughters. When the Maskin family went to visit her at the hospital, they learned her legs had been damaged, but she was told she might be able to walk again with the help of a crane or help of a cane or crutches, but she wouldn't be able to dance anymore. So as Rick told her, he made a wager with her. He bet her that 1 year from the day of that hospital visit that she would dance up the dirt road that leads to the Maskin home, and he would write a song for her to dance to. I'll let Rick finish the story in his words. The following week, while working in my garden, the entire song arrived. I ran to the house and wrote the lyrics down as fast as I could type. Better still, the words came with a melody. Barbara Broussel, who is now a well-known cabaret singer in New York City, did come dancing up our country road exactly a year to the day after the accident, with me singing and playing Let It Be a Dance. Barbara was limping, it's true, but she was dancing. I have a picture here of Miss Broussel that appears on one of her CDs. I'm guessing she's probably in her early 50s by now. She appears to have had a rather, and does have, successful singing and performing career. I know very little about her, other than the fact that she survived a horrible and deadly automobile accident as a teenager, and she's the person for whom Rick originally wrote his best-known poem and song. One now sung at UU gatherings and UU congregations around the country. It's even worked its way into a couple other hymnals of mainline Protestant denominations. Well, I'm very captivated by this story. I do have a sentimental side to myself. And yet I can hardly regard it as one with an entirely happy ending. Neither, I'm sure, it does Rick. Those three promising young lives remain as lost today as they were several decades ago. What those lives could have been, whether they could have gone on and had the same kinds of careers as one of the survivors, we'll never know that. What I do see in this story, though, is one more example of how even the most inexplicable and horrible tragedies and losses can still open the way for outcomes that cannot be seen or even imagined at the time that the horror and the loss take place. These outcomes, however terrible their origins, can end up being a blessing for other lives. This kind of understanding or hope, in fact, is really all I find that I have when it comes to coping with those times when bad things happen to good people, to use the title of Rabbi Kushner's well-known book. Well, okay, how about we take a step or two back for just a little bit of distance from what I've been kind of hitting you up close in the face with here so far. That's why we have a place like this where we can gather, where we can both engage with life and maybe step back from it from time to time as well. One of the unique features of this earthly creature that we are called a human being is that we've come to develop certain ideas, certain concepts about fairness and justice and what's right and what's wrong. If we didn't have these ideas and we didn't put them into practice, we wouldn't be able to live with one another. And then when some kind of inexplicable loss or tragedy occurs, in addition to this kind of visceral grief that we experience, we also experience a deep-seated sense of betrayal. This isn't fair. This is not how life is supposed to be. And for some, it can be a deep-seated crisis of faith. Why has God let such a terrible thing happen? To use some biblical imagery, I call these Job moments. But there's a story. The Old Testament folktale of Job. It's one I had to wrestle with for a while. Let's go in that direction for a few moments. The biblical scholars tell us there were many versions of this tale floating around in the ancient Near East some 2,500 years ago. It's as modern as Archibald MacLeish using its plot for his Broadway play, J.B., so it's had a certain amount of staying power over the centuries. The Old Testament version goes like this. God and Satan, or the adversary, as a better translation put it, make a wager about whether a good, righteous, and prosperous person like Job can be pushed to the point where he turns on God. So Job, poor guy, just there doing his living his life, things breaking for him, doesn't realize he's at a party in a cosmic bet, suddenly has everything go wrong with him, loses everything he has, including his children, gets these hideous boils over his body, his life just kind of basically goes to hell. To make it even not much more help, he's got these three friends that come around trying to tell him why everything that he's enduring, he's having to endure, which just puts him off even more, and so he finally just loses it. I mean, who wouldn't? He rails at God about all this unfairness and injustice and just plain horrible stuff that's happening to him. And God answers Job through a whirlwind, which seemed to be the Almighty's main mode of communication in those days. He wouldn't talk to God, he had a whirlwind. Speaks to him through a whirlwind and says, "Where were you when I laid the foundations of the universe?" Now, at the time when I was moving from a less theistic or a less God-focused view of the world in a more humanistic direction, and took an increasingly critical view of the Bible, I kind of tossed that passage overboard with a whole lot of other stuff I was given the heave-ho at that time, because I decided it was a cruel and heartless and foolish God being portrayed in this story. Here's poor Job crying out at his completely undeserved plight. The best God can do is say, "Shut up and deal with it." Decided this was a God I wasn't much interested in. But something kept bringing me back to that line, even as I rejected the kind of simplistic theology in which it was framed. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the universe? I kind of worked that one around in my head for a while, as I kind of tend to do, and this is the de-theologized message I gave to myself after a while. I said, "Well, who are you, Steve, to be demanding, much less expecting, that life always be fair and just? Where were you when the foundations of life and the universe were laid?" Nowhere. And that's the point. For life can come to us in beauty and in fullness, and it can just as easily and capriciously bring its cruelties and its unexpected losses. Yes, I tell myself, you can shape life to some extent. You can choose and you can shape your destiny to some extent. And you can celebrate the choices and the opportunities you have to do that. But you don't control life. It gives and it takes away. And the challenge of living is to have the resources from wherever we can get them, to be able to respond to what is given and what is taken. As Joni Mitchell said once, something's lost and something's gained in living every day. I got all that in one little verse. Sometimes when I read the Bible, I give myself a pretty free rein of interpretation, which is about the only way I can read it these days. So when I'm on the receiving end of any of life's deepest tragedies and losses, and I know each of you have been, be they due to an act of nature, or due to human folly, or failure, or cruelty, I and you should be able to expect and receive the love and the care and the support and the healing of those who are in empathy with us and those with whom we are in community. But playing off of the Job story, I don't feel I am owed a cosmic explanation, nor do I seek one, even for the cruelest of hands dealt. I can only live, or dance if you will, for as long as I have to do it, within a greater process. It was put in motion well before I arrived on the scene here, and it will go on when I'm no longer a part of it. Well, what if God, what, if anything, of God in all this? I like to think I have more faith options than the hard-nosed, if not realistic, deity of the book of Job, even if I do find some truth in the words the writer of this story puts it in this particular God's mouth. I think back to the service when I was ordained to the ministry, and I had a close friend, who remains a close friend to this day, sing Paul McCartney's Let It Be. I requested the song mostly, if not entirely, for the sake of one line in it. It goes, "And when the night is cloudy, there's still a light that shines on me. Shine on till tomorrow, let it be." That ceremony took place in a fairly liberal Baptist church, or at least liberal enough to let me work the Beatles into my ordination service. And even then, over 35 years ago, I knew on some level that the only sense that anything made to me when it came to talk of God was of McCartney's light that he speaks of there. I should have seen him where all that would eventually lead, which was here, but I eventually got here. Well, I'm bringing this back to Rick Maston and his song for one more round as a way of wrapping it up. Kind of doing a little jump from Let It Be to Let It Be a Dance. Sometimes I'm just too clever for my own. I got one more story that Rick, by his own admission, has probably told a thousand times himself. In fact, I think he told it here. It has to do with one of the lines in the Let It Be a Dance song that says, "Hug the laughter, bear the pain." Shortly after composing the song, Mr. Maston sang it to a performance that he did at a mental health facility. And a woman in the audience, who he recalls, gave every appearance of being very taken with this whole performance, was kind of put off by that concluding song. Because she had taken Rick's word in the word bear, B-E-A-R, to mean bear the pain, as endure it in repressed silence. She told him it should be bear, B-A-R-E, the pain instead. Don't keep it in. Here's Rick's words on that incident. As it turned out, she was the director of the place. The institution where she was the director, and in fact a good portion of the world, is inhabited by people who do not know how to spell the word correctly. We must learn not to bear the pain, not to keep it bottled up inside. Rather, we should bear it, share it, unburden ourselves of the sorrow and pain that come along with life. Since then, it's always been B-A-R-E, bear. But not quite. For when our current hymnal was published nearly 15 years ago, maybe more than that now, Rick was sent a copy of the text of Let It Be a Dance, so he could proofread it and see if they got it all right. And he noticed they had gone back to the B-E-A-R spelling. But here's his version of that, too. They changed the spelling back from bear to bear, but I kept mum about it. Why? Well, that typo has given me a punchline for every concert or reading I've ever done since. And he used the punchline here. And I did a random sample of our hymn books after yesterday as I was getting this thing ready. I noticed in some of the places after Rick's performance, in some of our hymnals, the word B-A-R is marked out and B-A-R-E has been written underneath it. So he has a little fun with this play on words. But his reason is well taken. We must learn not to bear the pain, not to keep it bottled up inside. Rather, we should bear it, share it, unburden ourselves of the sorrow and pain that comes with life. For that is all we can ultimately do with the tragedies that inevitably befall us in the course of living. We grieve them, of course. And then we find the means, and we find the people, and we find the place where and with whom we can bear them and ease the burden they bring. The burdens themselves will probably never completely disappear, but they can be lightened with the help of whatever light shines within and upon us, so that our life journeys may continue for as long as they are ours to have. The Reverend Greta Crosby, another of my UU ministerial colleagues, has observed that loss makes artists of us all as we weave new patterns into the fabric of our lives. That's what we seek to offer here. A community where you may grow a life. And there are times when such growth involves, as Reverend Crosby suggests, the weaving of a new pattern into one's life after that life has been diminished. A song that Rick Mastin wrote nearly 40 years ago helped one young woman weave a new pattern into her life. So whatever new patterns you may be needing to weave, I hope it is of help to you as well. We're going to sing that together. Jed's going to accompany us. It's number 311.